It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for tuning in today. On our last podcast, Kaylee Fretz, editor-in-chief of the new Escape Collective cycling website, was talking about the then imminent launch of the project and how some of the best journalists would be going in-depth to bring the cycling stories and information subscribers want. Well, Escape did go live this week and met its initial goals so that they could indeed sign some of the best journalists, photographers, editors, and developers in the business. A big congratulations to the collective, and I hope it continues to grow and do well. Meanwhile, this episode of the show features one of those great journalists. When we spoke, Joe Lindsay, who has been on the show in the past and who does some amazing reporting, as you will hear in a moment, alluded to what was coming next for him, and sure enough, he's the new senior editor at Escape Collective, and I think it's a match made in cycling heaven. Today's conversation with Joe is the result of some extensive research and reporting over the last couple of years. I don't know what you think or believe about autonomous vehicles, aka self-driving cars, or some of the functions that might no longer need a human to make decisions. But I think that you will find my conversation with Joe fascinating. After our break, I'll check in with Dennis Marcato Soriano, the executive director of the East Coast Greenway. As many of you know, I am a member of the Greenway Advisory Board, and I'm always pleased to be able to relay what's happening with funding, projects, and great stories from the Greenway's paths and trails. So let's get right to it. In his March article for Bicycling Magazine titled "Self-Driving Cars Won't Save Us Anytime Soon," Joe Lindsay goes into great detail to explain why that's so. In our conversation, he breaks down the range of autonomous vehicle categories, what is, or perhaps more appropriately, what is not happening with legislation, and why humans are still better than AI in a lot of ways. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on again. It's great to be here.
I read your article, and I am going to highly recommend that everybody reads this article. It was in Bicycling Magazine. It launched March 1st. Self-driving cars won't save us anytime soon. And I think that most of us don't understand the depth and scope of what self-driving autonomous means and how dangerous maybe an idea this is. So tell us a bit about the background of autonomous vehicles. This is not a new idea.
No, it's not. As I mentioned in the story, this stuff goes back to the 1950s when companies like General Motors and RCA and a few others were sort of collaborating on this idea of cars that could drive themselves. This is a key point in what the professor and author Peter Norton calls the Futurama, which is he pulls that name from a project that GM created for the 1939 World's Fair, the first ever Futurama exhibit that sort of imagined a city of the future, a transportation of the future. And they imagined it for 1960. And of course, none of what they imagined came true. And around in the 1950s, they put together another one, which was literally called Futurama 2, that sort of envisioned the same thing, that, you know, the city of the future. Now it was in the 1980s. And this was the first idea of cars that could drive without a human driver involved. And the idea there was is that it would be dumb cars on smart roads, that the roads would be equipped in ways to sort of control the cars. And GM and RCA actually collaborated on a prototype of this and trialed a full-size project at a track where the cars were basically the speed and acceleration, braking, and all of that was controlled by electronics in the road surface. And obviously, this never went anywhere either. And this is, as Norton writes, this is sort of a key idea of the Futurama, is that it's always 20 years away, which is close enough that people can be excited about it. Like, well, this could happen in my lifetime, but it's far enough away that we sort of forget the specifics when it never actually comes true. So that's sort of, that's the longer backstory of this. And the more recent version of this is it dates to the, basically back to what was the DARPA, the original DARPA Grand Challenge in 2004. And this was, DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And they fund all kinds of wacky research that might have interest in, you know, for military applications. And they sponsored this race in the Nevada desert in 2004, that was basically like the first autonomous vehicle race. And it was a spectacular failure. The quote-unquote winning entrant made it 7 miles on the course. And the course is about 140 miles of like off-road, you know, very rugged terrain, which is why they did it there. But then the next year, this is sort of an example of how quickly the technology can progress. The next year, there was a team that completed the whole course that within 18 months of basically starting this thing had devised a self-driving vehicle that could navigate through rugged desert terrain for 140 some miles.
So they go from zero to 60 in one year,
very
basically.
Much so.
Wow. So before we go on, let's sort of define what we mean when we talk about an autonomous vehicle, because it's really not just one thing.
Right. This is something that honestly was a little bit difficult for me to wrap my head around. I think it's very difficult for a lot of people to do so. And quite honestly, some of the sort of guidance, the expert guidance that we have is not that clear. The way I would put it is that think of autonomy as a spectrum. The basic definitions of this come from the Society of Automotive Engineers, the SAE, which is kind of the longest standing and oldest, you know, most important group, independent group for the automotive industry on engineering. And they have levels of autonomy that go from 0 to 5 and sort of describe increasing levels of autonomous behavior in vehicles. Level 0 is stuff like, there are passive things like, you know, blind spot warnings, proximity indicators, that kind of stuff. At the other end of the scale is what's called level 5 autonomy. And that is literally go anywhere, drive anything, anytime, any road. The car drives itself all the time and the human never has to play any role whatsoever. You get in, you're just strictly a passenger. And then in between that, there's all of these other levels, you know, 1 through 4, basically. At the bottom, levels 0 through 2 are what's called driver assistance, advanced driver assistance features, or ADAS. And these are features that basically assist the human driver, but the human driver is technically in control the whole time and has to monitor the vehicle. Level 4 and 5, as I mentioned, those are full autonomy. The vehicle drives itself entirely. The human never has to take any kind of role. The difference between level 4 and level 5 is that in level 4, it can do that only within a sort of a specifically defined area, which is called an operational design domain. That's the geographic area and the set of conditions in which it can operate. And those conditions could include things like weather. And then in the middle of all this, the most confusing thing is what's called level 3 autonomy, which is conditional automation. And we are just starting to see the first vehicles with this come out. Mercedes-Benz is basically going to be the first company to sell a system like this in the United States, and they'll start in Nevada. Their system is called Drive Pilot. And conditional autonomy is very similar. It's a lot closer to level 4 than it is to level 2. It's basically the same thing. The car can handle all of the driving tasks within a very limited operational design domain. It's basically intended to be used on separated highways where you have one-way traffic, there's restricted entry, that, you know, basically only motor vehicles all going in the same direction.
Wow.
Yeah, right. Get your head around all of that.
Yeah, let me reintroduce you and then we're going to sort of get into the weeds a little bit more. We're speaking with Joe Lindsay. He's a journalist who wrote this article for Bicycling Magazine. It's a long article. Grab yourself a cup of coffee or a beer and sit down and read it. Self-driving cars won't save us anytime soon. And boy, I am so on that side of it. It seems to me drivers are awful the way they are. Give them less to do. It seems like it's going to be even more dangerous. But humans, you say that humans are imperfect. However, when it comes to our being able to make decisions, we can process information apparently better and differently than asking a car to do it. So give us an example of how maybe a human could be more perfect in coming to some sort of a conclusion about when to go, when not to go, when to turn, when not to turn, compared to a car that's supposedly programmed to do that.
Okay. So the first thing I want to point out here is that humans are, when we're paying attention, we're actually really good drivers. The crash rate per mile, like our safety record, is something like 99.983% accurate as far as avoiding crashes. That the problem, as you mentioned, is when we're not paying attention. When we talk about human drivers versus autonomous drivers, the key thing to remember there is sort of the difference in how they understand their worlds. And we're talking about the difference between human cognition and perception and decision-making versus how a machine will do it. A human has basically contextual ability that we built up, as one source told me, over millions of years, where we're very able to respond to lots of very small little pieces of minutiae in our environment that that make sense to us as humans and how we communicate with other humans that an autonomous vehicle doesn't have. So an autonomous vehicle runs on artificial intelligence, and specifically a form of it called machine learning. And that is basically, it's kind of a brute force approach where you basically code the machine to understand every possible scenario that you could ever have in a driving environment. So if you're at a four-way stop sign, all the possible things that could happen at a four-way stop sign. A human doesn't need that. We can contextualize new information or new situations based on experience. We don't have to have seen that exact thing before. So there was a guy, I talked to him a year and a half or two ago for the story and ended up not quoting him, but his name's Sam Anthony, and he's the CEO of a company called Perceptive Automata. And this company basically works in the self-driving space to try to make autonomous vehicles behave better around vulnerable road users like pedestrians and cyclists. And just a little while ago, last year, he wrote in a blog post that the difference is that a human can understand contextual information in like a quarter second. A human driver can look at a pedestrian and understand information about them that a self-driving car never can. It can understand things about their intention, their behavior, their emotional state. If they're agitated, we may drive more carefully around that person because we know instinctually that they're less predictable. The car doesn't have that. So it basically tries to use a sort of minimal number of contextual inputs about this person, this pedestrian or cyclist, which direction they're moving, how fast they're moving, what environment are they in, and then computes a range of possibilities and probabilities that assigns to that. So let's take a look at like a cycling specific example would be like a cyclist making a right turn. So how do you signal a right turn? Like the legal way to signal a right turn is with your left arm up with your elbow at a 90 degree angle. So you can train an autonomous vehicle to recognize that signal and it will say this cyclist is turning right. But that's not the only way that cyclists signal this, right? Some of us stick our right arm straight out. And humans contextually, instinctually understand that that means either this person's going to take a right turn. Sometimes we stick our right arm out for just a half second. Sometimes you sort of stick it out and you just like point or shake a finger, these kinds of things. So each of those eventualities has to be specifically coded into the system for the vehicle to recognize what it is that's going on there. At another level, humans can understand, instinctually can understand something like how a cyclist countersteers. That if I very briefly, if I'm going to make a right turn and I very briefly, as we all do, sort of flick the bike to the left a little bit to set up the countersteer, to set up the turn, the human will recognize that and say, that person's not turning left. They're actually turning right because this is a countersteer. The vehicle will recognize that as soon as you actually start to make the turn. But does it recognize the countersteer? Only if it's programmed to do that. So there's this vast gulf in how humans and how machines perceive the world, where the way that autonomous vehicles do this is completely different from the way humans drive and make the sort of behavioral decisions that we need to operate around other people in traffic.
Wow. It seems like they could never really get there. And so that is some of what I want to talk about. What is ADAS?
ADAS. So as we mentioned, this is Advanced Driver Assistance Systems. And these are the level 0 to 2 systems that we were just talking about. They're basically systems that help the human driver to drive better. And they basically come in two broad flavors. One of them is the proximity warning kind of approach, or automatic emergency braking is another example of things that sort of augment the driver's own capabilities. They will alert you to problems. They will sort of help step in if the driver, you know, the automatic emergency braking will work if the driver themselves does not brake. That is preceded by usually a series of visual and audible warnings that say, like, collision apparent, you should brake. And then if you don't do that, the car will brake on its own. So that's the first flavor. The second flavor is, and we see this a lot in level 2 ADAS, is the stuff like Tesla's autopilot, for example, that can take over partially automate some of the driving tasks. And so in level 2 ADAS, at the sort of the furthest level of this, on the freeway, it can handle speed and acceleration. It can handle keeping a constant distance to the car in front of you. It can handle braking when it slows. It can even, in some instances, handle lane changes to go around other traffic and that kind of thing. So this is stuff, this is the most kind of, I would say, dangerous level of this, because you are partially automating part of the driving task, not all of it. And the human still has to monitor things. And the issue there is that, as one source with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety told me, we're really bad at that. In whatever industry you might choose, ranging from healthcare all the way up to astronauts, we're just really bad at being automation supervisors. We get bored, our attention wanders, we get distracted. And then when we need to pay attention, our minds are elsewhere, and it's really difficult for us to come back to that task.
So the auto industry is going to be looking at installing these systems as they figure out how to make them work. How are they? Well, I want to talk about regulation is really where I'm going with this. But you know what? Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that. I really want to know what the industry is saying, the people making cars, and what government is saying, and then how it's going to affect us as vulnerable road users. We're talking with Joe Lindsay. He's a journalist who wrote this amazing article. You need to go read it. It is called Self-Driving Cars Won't Save Us Anytime Soon. I absolutely believe that's true. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and if you're just joining me, you need to rewind, because this is a fascinating conversation. I don't know if you have a car that has some of these self-driving or autonomous kind of systems on them. Emergency braking is one. Joe, isn't it being mandated that all cars have some sort of a braking warning on them soon?
There's not currently regulations or mandates that cars need to have this technology. That's the purview of the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, and they have not made that decision yet. They're like a lot of federal agencies, they're pretty slow to act. They have recommended that automatic emergency braking is a technology that car makers should put in vehicles. And there was a voluntary agreement among car makers that dates back to 2020 or 2019, rather, where they would start to include this particular feature on substantially all cars sold in the United States. And we're getting very close to nearly full deployment of that, as far as the number of, it may not be a standard feature, but it is at the very least included as an option package on almost every vehicle sold in the United States. And that sort of underlines the spread of driver assistance, of ADAS systems in this world, is that most cars sold today, most new cars sold today, have at least one of these technologies already in them. So if you're, whatever it is, it's Subaru's EyeSight, it's Ford's Copilot 360, it's Nissan's ProPilot Assist, it's Tesla's Autopilot, they all come with these sort of fancy names for the whole suite of features. But that describes a series of discrete functions, which they will have to some extent.
So, you know, it brings to mind whether having these things makes it better or worse for us as drivers. It seems that, especially since the pandemic, drivers seem to be angrier, in a bigger hurry, less courteous. I mean, you can just tick off all those things, and maybe it would be helpful to have the car make some decisions. But I'm wondering if it really will be. One of the most high profile incidents was in 2018. And I think this is what brought it to a lot of people's attention. When there was a woman crossing the street walking a bike, I think it was in maybe Arizona. And it was an Uber car. It was on its automatic autonomous driving. There was a person in the car who was supposed to be monitoring it. The car did not, I mean, it made all these decisions and hit the woman anyway. So the driver was cited. She's standing trial, maybe in May, the driver who wasn't really driving. And everybody said, oh, this is horrible. It set the industry back, blah, 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 blah. Are there any regulations in the works because of this or since this? And if there are no firm and meaningful regulations, what are we doing with autonomous vehicles?
So there are no federal regulations on autonomous vehicles. And when I say that, I'm speaking here of fully autonomous vehicles like the Uber that you mentioned here. There are also almost no regulations on the driver assistance technology itself. So when you have a situation like this, there have been two bills that have been pending in Congress since 2017 that would put in place some kind of regulation on full self-driving vehicles. Neither of these are very good bills. The advocacy community for cyclists and pedestrians has a lot of concerns about them, that they're maybe a little bit or a lot too industry friendly, but they would be a starting point, and we don't have that. Since Elaine Hertzberg, the woman who was killed in Arizona, since that crash in March of 2018, so 5 years ago now, there has been virtually no change in the regulatory environment at the state or federal levels. More states have put in place regulations around testing of fully autonomous vehicles, but the regulations that they are putting in place are extremely industry friendly. And really, as Jennifer Homendy, who's the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, told me, the Hertzberg crash should have been a wake-up call to regulators, and it really wasn't, and that's unfortunate. And honestly, I have to say, I think the NTSB played a little bit of a role there, because in its report about that crash, as you mentioned, the human driver, the backup operator of that Uber, is the only person who's ever been criminally charged in this case. And this is despite the NTSB report, which went into lengthy detail about the sort of systemic failures in safety culture at Uber itself. And yet, through all of that, the report identified the primary cause of crash as the backup operator's failure to monitor the environment. And I thought that that was a real missed opportunity to basically put the industry on notice that, like, you guys are going to have to be responsible for this too. You cannot put it all on the human in the driver's seat if you're developing this kind of technology.
Well, the whole point of the technology is to take the human out of it eventually. I mean, that's what right. It sounds like. So then turning, you know, pointing the finger at that human, taking the blame off themselves just makes them, look the way they do.
Yeah, ridiculous. There's definitely a sense of injustice to this. I feel like where this person, this woman was, is bearing the full brunt of this. And Uber had settled a few claims with some of Hertzberg's relatives very quickly after the crash. Like the stuff never even got filed in civil court, basically. And so obviously Uber recognizes its responsibility here, but the fact, and this incident basically, this crash basically killed Uber's self-driving program, that they stopped testing entirely for a period of about 6 months, and they sold the whole division to a self-driving company called Aurora at basically 50% loss. So it got Uber out of the deal entirely. And of course, now Uber has come back to Aurora and is sort of starting to license back the technology that it sold. So they're not completely out of it. They're out of the development side. Aurora is, my sense is a more responsible company than Uber ever was with this stuff. The CEO there is a guy named Chris Urmson, and he's a former Google self-driving cars employee. He at least outwardly sort of says all the right things about safety and that kind of thing. So I'm hopeful that that it's in more responsible hands there now. But they're, of course, not the only company in the space by any stretch.
Yeah, really. Recently, Tesla recalled, 360,000 cars? Was that about some self-driving features?
Yes. So this was about its autopilot suite. And again, this is a driver assistance suite that's been around since 2016. And it's one of two driver assistance features that Tesla packages that Tesla offers. The other one is called full self-driving. And this one really gets me going because this is where we start to get into the whole aspect of deceptive marketing and what's called autonomy washing, which is what it sounds like. It's like sports washing or green washing. It's the marketing of a technology as more autonomous than it is. And this is what's really, I think, at the root of why people are so confused about these things. So autopilot is technically a level two driver assistance technology. And it was recalled, a voluntary recall, which means that Tesla agreed to the action because, as the wording was, that the car may behave unsafely. Basically, if the autopilot setting, the driver could basically set it to ignore speed limits, more or less, to speed. It would behave around intersections unsafely. It might roll through a stop sign. It might, you know, make a right turn on red where that wasn't allowed, that kind of thing. So Tesla did a recall of every single vehicle it sold that has a self-driving package that this autopilot package enabled. And is basically that, in this case, that is a software update that they have not said what the change will be. They have not said how long it's going to take to roll out. They have also not said why they didn't put this in autopilot to begin with. My guess is that it's something that Tesla engineers are sort of madly coding as we speak, but there's been very little information since the recall announcement of what it is they plan to do and how that's going to change. In the meantime, there's still the full self-driving package, which is sort of above and beyond this. It's actually a more capable package, but it's also more susceptible to misuse. And that has not been touched by this. And that is that package and autopilot both are now under investigation. Tesla is under investigation for those packages by, I'm gonna miss something here. The California Department of Motor Vehicles, the NHTSA, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Department of Justice is investigating them over these packages, including the deceptive marketing of them.
So to sort of bring it full circle, what do you see as the future of autonomous vehicles and the regulation that might be necessary? And, you know, I'm not a big, force people to do things, but I think these auto manufacturers, I'm going to make sort of this blanket statement about the bicycle industry, too. Over the years, it's had a habit of using the customer as the guinea pig for new product, you know, because everybody wants the newest and best. And so if a handlebar breaks, okay, we'll go back and fix it. If a quick release doesn't work, it sounds like the same kind of thing, allowing the consumer to do the testing and to pay the price. And so there's no regulation. Do you believe there will be regulation and will it work? Is there a future, or is it going to be, as you say, right in your introduction of your, that it won't save us, self-driving cars won't save us anytime soon?
Yeah, so there is a lot to unpack there. I think regulation is coming. As I said, the NHTSA in particular moves slowly on this, but they have started to move. They are requiring now for all companies that are developing level 4 and 5 technology to submit crash reports, and for all car companies that make cars with level 2 systems, they're requiring those brands to submit reports of any crash that they become aware of. And there's a little bit of sausage making there, because if the only reason that a car brand is going to become alerted to this is if they have some kind of telemetry enabled in the vehicle, which Tesla does, that will basically alert them that this vehicle was in a crash. or if they get a consumer complaint. And so the first round of data that we got from this was back in July 2022, the first year's worth. Three quarters of the crashes involving level two vehicles were Teslas. And so Tesla is overrepresented. And this is just scratching the surface of how many crashes likely happen in cars with this technology active and enabled at the time of the crash. But Tesla is overrepresented because it has telemetry. So back to the point about regulation is, I think the NHTSA is moving on this. They typically move pretty cautiously. The model to look at is in Europe, where the European regulators, they call it the New Car Assessment Program, or NCAP, has long had provisions to test vehicles for their driver assistance systems, and also crucially for how they protect people outside of the vehicle in a crash. So how their pedestrian detection systems work, that kind of thing. That provides NHTSA with a proven model to follow if they want to step into this. And I think there's growing pressure on them to do that. And I think this is something that only can happen at the federal level. You mentioned the bike industry. And right now, yeah, it's exactly the same, where it's the regulatory environment is sort of best characterized as beg forgiveness rather than ask permission. A great example is helmets with the CBSC, where every helmet sold in the U.S. has to have that sticker on it, but the CBSC itself does not test those helmets. The helmet companies themselves do their own testing and self-attest that it meets these standards. And so, as you know, as everybody, most industry folks listening to this podcast also know, not a year goes by without a helmet recall because some company realized that, oh, in fact, its helmet doesn't pass this test, that there is a risk of injury. I don't know. The CPSC as an agency is not funded to test all of these consumer products. What we hear about right now with, passing laws to require e-bike batteries to certify to a underwriter's laboratory standard is another great example. There's so much. This is just bicycles. And then there's only a few categories of consumer product, most of which is around babies, where there is actual testing mandated, independent testing mandated to before you sell this product. I think cars can and should be a qualitatively different situation, primarily because of the difference in the potential for harm to others. If your handlebar breaks, that's really, really bad. It's really bad for you personally. It is not likely to set off a chain reaction crash that kills a whole bunch of other people or harms a whole bunch of other people. Cars, simply by virtue of their size and weight, are basically a guided missile in the urban environment. They will kill if they are not monitored. And I think that makes for a kind of qualitatively different approach that's needed there. I would love to see more regulation for the cycling industry as well, but short of a massive increase in funding and capability for agencies like the CPSC, that's not likely to happen. It's much more possible we could see that happen with autonomous vehicles and with driver assistance technology specifically, because I think that's where we're really falling down right now, because this stuff is out there. It does exist. Self-driving cars do not as of yet. And as I wrote in the story, even if we get some kind of AI breakthrough in the next couple of years, it's going to take decades to turn over the vehicle fleet in the United States. This is not ChatGPT. You cannot deploy it at scale as a in a web browser. You've got to actually build the damn cars. And so that's something where, yes, we need regulation on that, but I think let's triage this and let's do regulation on ADAS first.
So true. So true. The whole thing is just terrifying in some ways. I know so many people who have stopped riding the roads because of the actions of drivers, and then to have cars that might be unreliable on top of it, it just doesn't sound like a good recipe. Well, Joe, I so appreciate the work you did on this particular article. Again, we're speaking with Joe Lindsay. He is a journalist. His article is in Bicycling Magazine, March 1st, Self-Driving Cars Won't Save Us Anytime Soon. I really encourage everybody to read it and to share it, because I think it's a really important article. It's an important topic, especially to us as cyclists. And I just so thank you for writing it.
Thank you for having me on and talking about it. I appreciate sort of any opportunity or platform I get to share this message.
It's great. What are you working on now? What other amazing article will you be working on next?
Well, I'm actually in a little bit of a quiet spot since publishing that piece. I've definitely got some ideas and things. There's a lot of stuff percolating. I hope to have some announcements soon. It's just not something I'm quite ready to share yet. I hate to be coy about it, but that's where I'm at.
That's cool. A quiet spot's always good. Well, Joe, thank you so much. Again, I appreciate your time, and I certainly appreciate the amount of effort and work you put into this. You take care. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
All righty.
My thanks as always to Joe Lindsay for his amazing reporting. There is a link to Joe's article from Bicycling on our website, outspokencyclist.com, and you can bet you'll see a lot more of Joe's work at Escape Collective. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with the East Coast Greenway's Dennis Mercado Soriano. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I am your host, Diane Jenks. With more than 1,000 completed miles of the 3,000 planned miles of the Maine to Florida East Coast Greenway, it's time to check in with Executive Director Dennis Mercado Soriano to wrap up 2022 and dive into what's happening in 2023. With the new initiative, Greenways for All, Dennis gives us some insight into the difference between yes, we want to make consequential changes for safer and better walking and biking, and what might actually be holding us back from seeing it happen.
Hi, Dennis. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. I'm looking forward to our catching up. We haven't talked in a while.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Always my pleasure. So let's talk about catching up on 2022. What transpired with the East Coast Greenway during last year before we jump into what's new for this year?
Oh, wow. Absolutely. It's incredible. There's so much momentum. That's the story of the East Coast Greenway these days. We actually, if you look at the last 2 years, we have attracted $750 million in infrastructure investment to plan, design, and construct the East Coast Greenway. So we're trying to build on that momentum. And we have this federal funding opportunity that we've never seen before at this scale. So it's all about making the most of this historic infrastructure moment.
Is this all coming from the infrastructure bill that was passed, or are there various sources out of the federal government and then local governments?
Absolutely. All of the above. We have cities and counties stepping up. We have states stepping up, and we have the federal government stepping up. So a record amount of U.S. DOT raise grants last year, about $50 million flowed from that last year. Just this year, a new program called Safe Streets for All. There's a lot of support that came from that. We have Congress members who are funding earmarks to move the East Coast Greenway forward throughout the corridor. And it's just amazing to see that progress, because we need it. We want this greenway to be done so that everyone can ride it, so that my kids, when they tell me they graduate from high school or whatever, and they say, okay, I want to go Maine to Florida with my buddies. See you later, Dad. I want to be like, great, go for it. And I'm not worried about it, because the space that we put together is safe and accessible to everybody. And I really feel like that's possible if we make the most of this infrastructure moment.
How many miles were added in 2022? We'll go back. We'll catch up with 2023 in a bit.
Absolutely. So 2022, we had 18 new segments from 11 different states out of our 15 states. There were a lot of little connections. But those little connections can turn into a transformative 10-mile ride or 20-mile ride. a key connection, because as you know, when you're biking around in your town and your city or in a new place, that bike network is only as good as the weakest link, right? If there's a really dangerous intersection, you don't want to ride the whole 10 miles. So what we're doing is we're making those small connections that turn into 10, 20 plus mile rides that everyone can enjoy.
Let me reintroduce you, and we're going to catch up with what's going on now. Another new initiative, kind of exciting. I want to talk about it. We're speaking with Dennis Marcato Soriano. He is the executive director of the East Coast Greenway. And full disclosure, I am on the advisory board. So I try to talk to Dennis several times a year, or John, or whoever is available to talk with me about exciting initiatives. And one that I just got back in, I guess it was January, you released a new initiative, Greenways for All. What is it?
First, thank you for being on our advisory board and spreading the word about the Greenway. We really appreciate it. Now, Greenways for All is about making the most of this infrastructure moment. It's about taking the expertise that we've developed over the many years. We have a team of 16 staff now.
Wow.
It's big growth. We started, you know, when I started 13 years ago, it was 4 staff and it was fantastic, but it felt almost like a pipe dream that we're going to get this Greenway done, right? Now it feels very possible. It feels, dare I say it, inevitable that we're going to get this Greenway done, you know? So what we're doing is really building a great future. You know, it's just an incredible amount of people, the staff, and Greenways for All. What we're doing with this is, okay, we've turned $20 million in donors' support over the past 30 years into $2 billion in infrastructure investment to build out the many, many miles of East Coast Greenway that exist. It's over 1,000 miles. It hosts 50 million bike rides, runs, and walks per year now. And we see dramatic potential to keep growing that and make this truly the most popular park in America. So Greenways for All is about sharing that knowledge that we've attained on how to find funding for this on the local level, on the state level, on the federal level, helping people navigate this infrastructure moment and getting the Greenway done. So we have this short window, this 4 more years of $100 billion per year flowing toward transportation infrastructure. And we have in our release for Greenways for All, we put out a video saying, what would you like with this infrastructure moment? Do you want more of this? And we show these images of honking and full of traffic and huge trucks and everything just clogging up our communities. And then we have another image, the alternative, or this safe space, miles of smiles, sanctuaries of sanity, completed Greenway for everyone to enjoy. We're trying to put that juxtaposition because right now, federal leaders, they're spending $100 billion a year, which could either be status quo or it could be transformation for all of us that love to bike.
So do you think that the message is getting through? And if it is, who's getting it? If it isn't, who isn't getting it?
We just started and we're not there yet. We're not strong enough yet as a movement. We all love biking and we're making good progress here and there and many, many places. But when I walk outside in this building and I look around, I see how are people getting around in our country? I'm not seeing the climate crisis solutions that we need. I'm not seeing the public health solutions that we need. I see way too many cars and the cars are getting bigger. And that's a real threat. We're seeing, unfortunately, the amount of fatalities that cyclists, you know, we're facing among cyclists and pedestrians, both people walking and biking. There's more deaths than there were 20 years ago. And that's just simply not okay. So there's this deep need to really transform our infrastructure, to set up those safe networks that welcome everyone into the joy of cycling that you and I have. Not everyone's going to join us unless we have the right corridors, the right accessible, convenient routes to get around on two wheels. And it's going to take a while, but we have a great secretary, Secretary Pete Buttigieg. He's biked to work some, and, you know, he's visited the Atlanta Beltline. So he's seen the power of greenways, president that enjoys biking in Delaware in his home state and with his wife. So the pieces are in place, but we're not there yet. And that's why we started Greenways for All, so that we can get there, so that we can hear from federal leaders, from state leaders, from local leaders, that they are going to prioritize. This is not just a nice to have, that this is an urgent matter. And they're going to prioritize completing the East Coast Greenway and Greenway networks all around the country.
Do you think there's anybody, if you presented the Greenway concept to legislators or climate deniers, who would look at it and say, yeah, this is never going to be okay. We don't want this. Is there anybody who really says, we don't want a safer way to bike? We don't want a safer way to walk? Is there anybody who actually thinks that way?
I don't know if there is. I don't see them around. What I see, though, the main problem I see is our current leaders, they smile, they light up when we say greenways. They nod when we say we need to invest in this. But they're not always making the transformative investments that are necessary. If we have 15% of our trips are biking and walking in our country, why don't we get 15% of our federal transportation dollars? Why are we fighting for 1-2%? Maybe it'll increase to 2.5%. That, you know, if it stays at that level, we're not going to have the transformation we need. We're not going to be able to. I want to compete with the Netherlands, with Germany, and all these wonderful countries that have built up in ways that you can bike and walk much more seamlessly in the community. You can enjoy it recreationally, commuting to school, to work, all of that. And it's very safe. When you look at the safety over the past 20 years, it's gotten safer, much safer to bike in Europe, but it's gotten less safe to bike in our country. So we've got to make the investments. So I really feel like the problem is there's a lack of urgency. There's this feeling that, yeah, I like it, and I'll throw a little bit of support this way and that. But what we have to do as a country, what we have to do throughout our East Coast Greenway Corridor, Maine to Florida, is really put forward a vision of a better future and how investing in biking and pedestrian networks can get us to that future. But it's a serious investment. We have $100 billion a year flowing. All we need to complete the East Coast Greenway is 1% of that. 1%.
It seems like such a small amount, and the benefits seem to so outweigh the investment. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
Everybody's talking about climate and health.
Yeah.
And yet that's not, even though they talk about it, it sounds like lip service a lot of the times.
Yeah. I don't want to say, sorry, Dander, I don't want to say that every elected leader is bad or anything like that. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is we have to act with more urgency. This is our moment to act. And we care about climate. We care about public health. So let's act accordingly and let's shift our investment to the next level.
Before we sign off today, we're going to talk about how people can get involved in Greenways for All. And contacting legislators is a way to do that. And I think it's Absolutely. An important way to do that. And your local, you know, I know that a lot of stuff starts local. It doesn't necessarily, mm-hmm. Maybe you don't have the big federal vision. You don't have the big 50 state vision, but you can have your community vision. Absolutely. And it's important that you do that. In fact, just a little side note, I live in a small sort of ring suburb of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined the nonprofit One South Euclid to just get some of this stuff talked about and
yes.
done. And we're starting to do some things with some of the transportation issues in our little community, which are horrible, by the way. I mean, you know, there's no bus lines. There are very few, if any, bike paths. But now people are starting to open their ears a little bit and say, well, maybe. When
Good.
Before they were saying no. So I want to ask you I want you to tell a story from last year, which caught my attention. And that is, there was a guy who rode the entire Greenway on a unicycle.
This is incredible.
It's a great story. Go ahead and tell it.
Okay. There's a young guy, a 19-year-old from Maine, from Wells, Maine. But let's bring it back even younger. So he's a little kid. He's going to school in Jacksonville, Florida. And his teacher tells him about this thing called the East Coast Greenway. And his eyes light up. But he doesn't realize how much that's going to impact his life. Because then fast forward, he's living up in Maine. And there's, you know, the COVID crisis hits. And there's this period in his life where he's like, wait a second. I actually have a few months where I have to take some classes, but they don't start until a few months from now. So what should I do? I love unicycling. Maybe I'll tackle the whole East Coast Greenway on one wheel, which is crazy. And he does it. And if you see our video about it, he starts out, he's going through his driveway, and what happens? He falls over, right coming out of the driveway with his mom right there, who's already worried about it, right?
Right.
You're going to try to get all the way down to Florida. He falls over. But what does he do? Does he give up? No. He gets right back up, and he just starts unicycling from community to community, making friends. This guy is a really nice guy. I had the joy of being able to bike with him. I was biking. He's unicycling. And I noticed as a cyclist, man, I have it easy. This guy, seriously, I'm just coasting along. You know, I can take my hands off. I can relax, whatever, and keep riding. But he's really focused, like getting over like a small twig or something, you know, or going from if there's a lip in the pavement, like he's got to really maneuver that. So kudos to him. He really incredible young man. And I loved it. His message, he's our most effective messenger. He got the East Coast Greenway out like never before, over a billion in reach. So the East Coast Greenway profile went way up because he was doing this just incredible thing. The first unicyclist to ever go from Maine to Florida on the East Coast Greenway. He even got roasted by Jimmy Fallon in Late Night, you know? So that, you know, you made it when...
Right.
Some of those guys making a joke about you. So really nice to work with them. I'm so glad he got down to Key West and had a good time. He did one interview where he's in a tent in the middle of a thunderstorm. He's talking to ABC News National. And he even invited like this lovely little cat into his tent because it was a storm. And he's like, you know, the guy was making friends the whole way down. And that's what we want to do with this Greenway. You know, we want to build community. We don't want there to be so much division. You know, we've got real issues we need to tackle together, right and left, north and south, all the division lines you can think of. Like, we want to bring people together so that we can really, you know, build a future that everyone can enjoy. And you know, and so this young man, Avery Suter, was doing that. He was living that dream. And I'm so happy that he did it, and that we got to work with him in that way. And yeah, one of the best messengers we've ever had.
Oh, I am sure that it just sounded like it's crazy and it worked.
Yeah.
So what could be better? What events are coming up for 2023 for the Greenway?
Okay. We've got a really cool ride. I'd love for your viewers to check out. It's Ride the State Connecticut. It goes from New Haven, the New Haven Green, One of the first patents ever for a bicycle was right there. It was developed right there in Connecticut, really close to the New Haven Green. And so we start there and we ride north all the way to the Massachusetts border. It's about a 56-mile ride. And it's always a joy. There's so much great energy. This will be on Saturday, June 24th. So would welcome everyone to come, you know, check it out, greenway.org. You can find this event really soon. We're about to announce it, but your listeners will get the early word. And yeah, we'd love to have people from near and far to come out and enjoy. We had about 150 riders and it sold out last year. So I encourage everybody to check it out. And if it's a good fit for your schedule, come on over.
What about the Philly, New York ride? Is that happening again?
Not this year.
Okay.
We're taking a pause. We loved it. But, you know, it's good to mix it up. So right. We're going to focus on Connecticut this year, and we'll see what happens next year. We might bring that back. We might do a ride in Boston. We might do rides all over the place. We're open. Okay.
Well, as always, it's wonderful to catch up. We've been speaking with Dennis Marcato Soriano. He is the executive director of the East Coast Greenway, greenway.org. greenwaysforall.org. Check it out. Talk to your legislators, talk to your mayors, talk to your city council people. Let's get people out on their bikes and let's finish the Greenway. That would be a real treat in my lifetime to see it be done.
Amen to that. We can do it. There's never been a historic moment like today. So if all of us, if we work together, we talk to our legislators, talk to the mayors and the governors, we can get it done.
Thanks, Dennis. I hope you have a great day. And we will talk again. As always, have a wonderful summer if I don't talk to you till next fall.
You too, Diane. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My thanks as always to Dennis for taking time to talk with me today. Check out greenwaysforall.org. and greenway.org for all the information about the East Coast Greenway and how you can get involved. Next time on The Outspoken Cyclist, I speak with Paul Tomei from the Cascade Cycling Club in Seattle. With over 10,000 members, this statewide club isn't fooling around when it comes to offering programs, rides, and legislative opportunities for better biking in Washington State. We also check in with our New York City ear to the ground biking and sustainability guru, John Sirico. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Please remember that every episode is available for download on our website, outspokencyclist.com, along with photos, links, and show notes. You can also subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Well, spring is about to spring, and I'm looking forward to warm and sunny days. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit outspokencyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.